Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Cindy reading Health and Wellness from the MRT for Wednesday. MMH, behavior health is a priority. Campus expected to be completed before 2024. By Stuart Doreen. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said the $40 million approved by the Texas legislature will be the first step in making a comprehensive behavioral health care center for the Permian Basin a reality. Myers said Midland Health officials and their counterparts at Medical Center Health System in Odessa came together to pitch the legislature of the need for the mental health facility in the region. Late Monday night, the Texas legislature approved Senate Bill 8, a bill making supplemental appropriations of specific funds Texas received under the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. According to State Representative Tom Craddock's office, SB 8 includes $40 million to expand access to mental health services in West Texas, by funding construction of a new mental health-focused hospital campus. Upon completion of the construction of the campus, it will be operated by a partnership between the Midland County Hospital District and Ector County Hospital District. Myers said Tuesday during Midland Health's weekly COVID-19 press conference that community and healthcare leaders in Midland have been talking about mental health going back to 2015, and even working with the Meadows Foundation about local mental health policies, a comprehensive study and recommendations moving forward. That's been clear from that point to this day that we are far short of meeting the needs of our community for behavioral health services of all kinds, Myers said. Everything from entry-level counseling for people with anxiety or depression through medical management with easy access to a psychiatrist, through inpatient care, if it's needed for people who have particularly difficult challenges in their lives. Russell Tippin, CEO and President, Medical Center Health System, added, "Mental health is the number one public health need in the Permian Basin, and this funding is a massive step in the right direction. We are thrilled to partner with our friends at Midland Health to start this venture and be the top provider of mental health care in West Texas." Both Myers and Tippin thank Craddock and State Representative Brooks Landgraf of Odessa for their work politically. Craddock's office reported that the Comprehensive Behavioral Health Care Center will not only include inpatient services, but also a crisis stabilization unit, therapeutic spaces appropriate for all ages, counseling offices, community education, and residency services. "Our communities in West Texas have a dire need for quality mental health care," Craddock stated in a press release. "The mental health hospital is a great stride toward meeting the mental health needs of West Texas. I am honored to have worked on securing this funding and look forward to this facility being a resource for generations to come." Myers said officials in Midland and Odessa have partnered to come up with preliminary plans for a mental health facility. He said that with a big step out of the way, that the hospitals can work with the state's facilities commission and take care of the particulars, including finding the right piece of land inside Midland, Odessa. Myers said he expects the facility will be highly accessible to those in Midland, Odessa, and other counties across the region. The campus is expected to be completed before 2024, according to Craddock's office. Myers also said the $40 million allocated will probably be a little less than we need to do this. A contact with the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center said the ask for a 100-bed facility for the region was more than double the amount the legislature approved. In that respect, this project will probably be like the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center, which started with a hefty contribution from the state and then relied on funding from those in both communities to finish the project. Meyer said he is optimistic about the ability to raise money needed for project completion. Options, he said, include asking the philanthropic community for help and capital formation, including the possibility of debt. It's more than likely our first approach will be to go to those donors in our community who have always supported us, Meyer said. We've been building support for a behavioral health initiative for a number of years now, and I think we've raised awareness and gotten a lot of people's attention about this. He added he looks forward to working with other providers in the community and Texas Tech University Health Science Center's psychiatric department to put together a behavioral health center that the region can really be proud of. This will become a very high priority for us immediately, Meyer said. Highlights from Pink the Park. Pink in the Park was held this past weekend at a new location. The program moved to Centennial Park, but still created awareness about breast cancer. The event included a breast cancer survivor speaker, victory walk, and recognition of breast cancer survivors. This year's Pink in the Park will be different from years past. Firstly, it will be at Centennial Park instead of Graffa Park. There also was a ribbon wall, look, feel good, shop, local vendors, family-friendly activities, raffle, and flamingo flock presale. Five things to know on breast health. Understanding your health can help prevent cancer. By Dr. Gina Campana, Midland Health. Breast cancer is the most common type of cancer among women in the United States. Early detection is key to catching breast cancer when it is most treatable. Understanding your options for your own breast health can provide you with a roadmap to know what to do. Here are five things to know to navigate your breast health. You can control some risk factors. You cannot change your age, personal or family history, or inherited genes, but you can manage other breast cancer risk factors. Here are steps you can take to reduce your risk. Maintain a healthy weight. Eat a healthy diet full of fruits and vegetables to boost your immune system. Do not use tobacco. Limit how much alcohol you drink. Exercise regularly. Genetics have an impact. About 5 to 10% of all women diagnosed with breast cancer have a mother, sister, or daughter who has also been diagnosed with breast or ovarian cancer. Women who have close blood relatives with breast or ovarian cancer are at higher risk, and the risk increases with every additional family member diagnosed before menopause. If this is the case in your family, consult your physician about your prevention plan. Consider getting a baseline mammogram at least 10 years before the age your family member was diagnosed. For example, if your mother was diagnosed at age 40, your baseline mammogram should be at age 30. Mammograms are not recommended before the age of 30. However, breast ultrasound and breast MRI can be performed in women at increased risk under the age of 30. Genetic testing is available at the Breast Center of Midland Health for those who qualify due to personal or family history, with genetic counseling provided if a genetic mutation is discovered. Detection is in your hands. You're the best judge of what's normal when it comes to your own body. Monthly breast self-exams can keep you familiar with the look and feel of your breasts, making it easier to identify and share any changes with your primary care physician. Screening saves lives. Screening with mammography is an essential part of your breast health. The American College of Radiology and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network recommend that women of average risk for developing breast cancer get yearly mammograms starting at age 40. Digital breast tomosynthesis, also known as 3D mammography, is considered the new standard of care. Women with dense breasts have it harder. More than 50% of women have dense breasts, which can mask abnormalities on a standard digital mammogram, making it more difficult to screen. Dense breast tissue is also an independent risk factor for developing breast cancer. Screening breast ultrasound is designed to supplement the yearly mammogram to detect cancer in women with dense breasts. Breast health takes time to navigate, and breast cancer prevention can be a multi-step journey. Your primary care physician can support you along the way and connect you with specialists in breast health to guide you through prevention and screening, as well as diagnosis and treatment if needed. FDA looks to allow sales of hearing aids in retailers. Washington. Health regulators on Tuesday unveiled their proposal to allow Americans to buy hearing aids without a prescription, a long-awaited move intended to make the devices more accessible to millions of people with hearing problems. The Food and Drug Administration said the proposed rule would cut red tape that currently requires hearing exams and a prescription for people with mild to moderate hearing loss. Under the plan, the devices could be ordered online or bought over the counter at pharmacies and other retail stores. The move follows years of pressure from medical experts and consumer advocates to make the devices cheaper and easier to get. More than 37 million Americans, or 15% of adults, have trouble hearing, according to the FDA. But only about one-fifth of people who can benefit from a hearing aid use one. Cost is the big obstacle. Between the device itself and fitting services, Americans can pay more than $5,000 to get a hearing aid. Insurance coverage is very limited, and Medicare doesn't pay for hearing aids, only diagnostic tests. U.S. officials said Tuesday that the FDA change, when finalized, should spur competition and bring down prices. Today, we open the door to an easier process and a more affordable process, Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra told reporters. The agency will take public comments on its proposal for 90 days before finalizing the new rules. FDA officials wouldn't speculate on when new devices would actually hit store shelves. Consumer electronic companies for years have produced lower-cost personal sound amplification devices, but U.S. regulations bar them from being marketed as hearing aids, and they do not undergo FDA review. Regulators said Tuesday that the new rules will make explicit that those devices are not alternatives to FDA-vetted hearing aids. Companies that market them inappropriately could face federal penalties, such as fines or product seizures. Once the FDA rules take effect, traditional manufacturers are expected to begin selling cheaper, direct-to-consumer models.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, October 19th. This article is entitled, OPEC Plus Fails Once Again to Meet Oil Production Target, by Salma Al-Wardani, Bloomberg. OPEC and its allies once again failed to pump enough oil to meet their output targets, exacerbating the supply deficit as the world recovers from the coronavirus pandemic. OPEC Plus cut its production 15% deeper than planned in September, compared with 16% in August and 9% in July, according to delegates familiar with the matter. This reflects the inability of some members, including Angola, Nigeria, and Azerbaijan, to raise output to agreed volumes due to a lack of investment, exploration, and other issues. In theory, OPEC Plus could have pumped an extra 747,000 barrels a day in September and remained within its agreed production limit. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, which include Russia, have been under pressure from major consumers to accelerate the pace of their supply increases. These calls have become louder as the energy crisis has engulfed Europe, sending power prices to record levels. Brent has rallied to the highest level since October 2014 as some power producers switch to oil in tandem with the global recovery. Asian demand for U.S. crude is also rising as energy crisis boosts prices for other grades priced against global benchmark Brent. The latest pressure came from Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who urged producers on Monday to ramp up output in the face of the recent price rise. He added that his government is watching price trends in the market to assess its impact on domestic industries. If prices do not turn around, the next OPEC Plus meeting on November 4th could take place with heightened political pressure from consumers. The meeting will also coincide with COP26 climate talks in Glasgow. With world leaders meeting to extract more ambitious promises from governments and global business to avoid a climate catastrophe, attention on the producer group will be even higher. This article is entitled, Oil Prices Reaching $100 a Barrel, Possible in Winter, Mercurius Says, by William Mathis and Javier Blas, Bloomberg. It's possible that oil will hit $100 a barrel this winter, but $80 to $90 a barrel is the expected range, said Marco Durnand, Chief Executive Officer of commodities trader Mercuria Energy Group Limited. With surging energy costs contributing to inflation as the global economy recovers from the pandemic, prices could still go higher, Dunan said at the Bloomberg NEF Summit in London on Monday afternoon. It's difficult to think the psychology of the market can be anything but bullish ahead of the winter, he said. We have a bullish view on commodities and on energy. China panic. Global climate talks that will kick off in Glasgow later this month come at a difficult time, as world leaders balance their climate ambitions with their current reliance on fossil fuels to power their economies. That conundrum is particularly acute for China, the world's biggest developer of renewable power and the biggest polluter, Dunan said. China's in a complicated place, he said. They made an effort to reduce coal production, and now there's panic because there's not sufficient inventory either of gas or coal. Still, Dunan believes China's leaders want to move aggressively to cut emissions. This article is entitled Commentary. Natural Gas Supply Chain Gets Upgrades by Todd Staples, Texas Oil and Gas Association. Vast improvements, particularly in communications, have been made since Winter Storm Uri to better prepare the natural gas supply chain for the winter season in Texas. The oil and natural gas industry has been working with a sense of urgency to improve the readiness of the system. Industry is working closely with state regulators to implement Senate Bill 3, which wisely calls for more clarity in the critical load designation process, mapping of natural gas facilities that are directly tied to power generation, and weatherizing those facilities. We also agree that Texas's vast supply of natural gas in storage plays an important role to help power generators better prepare for emergency weather events. Multiple reports have confirmed that loss of power was the greatest disruption to natural gas production and transportation during the storm. Pre-storm, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, critical load designation form excluded the majority of the natural gas supply chain, and during the storm, those facilities lost power. Keep in mind, this form does not guarantee a facility will keep its power during an emergency. Transportation distribution utilities, TDUs, must prioritize all critical assets, such as hospitals, nursing homes, and EMS, in addition to those facilities necessary for power generation. Not every natural gas facility is a priority from a power perspective during an emergency. This is why mapping is the most crucial part of the process. Identifying natural gas facilities directly tied to power generation is well underway. There are hundreds of thousands of natural gas facilities in the state, and not all of them supply natural gas for power generation. Industry is working with the Public Utility Commission, Railroad Commission, and Texas Department of Emergency Management to determine which facilities are directly linked to power generators, to ensure those facilities weatherize and maintain power during an emergency. Mapping hundreds of thousands of assets will take time, and many operators are charting their assets internally to assist in the process. TDUs must be able to implement load shed during an emergency. Intentionally cutting off power to some to ensure that there is enough power for the most essential. If TDUs were required to maintain power to every natural gas facility in Texas, it would create a dangerous situation by diverting power that may be needed elsewhere. Consider, too, that in certain cases, it may take more power from the grid to keep some wells on than those wells natural gas could make in more power. While we know the best way to keep natural gas moving during an emergency is to maintain power to facilities, natural gas operators also employ necessary techniques to appropriately winterize equipment, such as methanol injection units, pipe insulation, heat tracing systems, equipment shelters, and seasonal windbreaks. Much discussion surrounds a so-called opt-out provision in the law related to critical load designation and weatherizing. To be clear, facilities identified through mapping as being directly tied to power generation and deemed critical are not expecting to be eligible to opt out of weatherizing required by law. Finally, natural gas in storage is critical to emergency preparedness. Texas has 544 billion cubic feet of working natural gas storage. The electric generation sector only consumed about 4 billion cubic feet daily during normal winter operations. Natural gas storage must be planned for and purchased before a storm to be prepared. Texas needs to focus on how power generators can fairly be compensated for storing natural gas or purchasing it from storage as part of readiness plans, while maintaining and encouraging a competitive process that benefits consumers by keeping prices affordable. Fortifying the electricity grid and natural gas supply chain is a multi-step process, and significant, meaningful changes are already underway to ensure that our state system is winter ready.
Antibiotics for recurrent UTI cause concern. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a fit 85-year-old woman. I walk regularly and eat healthily. I have severe COPD and have been on the recommended dosage of Symbicort for 40 to 50 years. Within the past several years, I have been getting urinary tract infections every second month, if not every month. My doctor has given me a standing order for urinalysis and culture to determine the infection and prescriptions for an antibiotic to start when needed until the proper source is found. I am concerned that I take antibiotics 8 to 10 times per year, sometimes for several weeks. Is there any substitute for Symbicort if that is contributing to these infections? I fear becoming immune to antibiotics. Signed, L.F. Answer. I think it is unlikely that Symbicort, which is a combination of the inhaled steroid budesonide and the long-acting beta agonist formoterol, has anything to do with your urinary tract infections. In women in their 80s, by far the most common cause for a UTI is loss of estrogen, leading to thinning in the lining of the vulva and vagina, including the lining of the urethra. Without a good seal from healthy tissue, bacteria can get into the urethra and bladder, causing a urine infection. Your primary doctor or a gynecologist can take a look and prescribe topical estrogen if needed. Oral steroids can increase the risk of many infections, but inhaled budesonide is not absorbed into the body very well. It works for the most part directly in the lungs, but some systemic absorption does occur. For example, there seems to be an associated increased risk of developing glaucoma and cataracts. Very high doses of inhaled steroids may slightly increase the risk of osteoporosis. But I want to emphasize that this risk is very small compared with using oral steroid drugs like prednisone. There has not been shown an increase in the risk of urine infections from inhaled steroids.
This is the Dear Abby column. Aunt ready to offer advice to childless niece. Dear Abby, my niece Jane is married to John, who doesn't want children. Before she met John, Jane always loved children. She says he was traumatized by the toxic relationship between his parents and their subsequent divorce. John's father told him often that he and his siblings caused the divorce. John refuses to have a vasectomy despite the fact he doesn't want children and insists that Jane use an IUD to prevent a pregnancy. I think it's the height of selfishness. Three of my closest friends married men who didn't want children. After age 40, they were all divorced. The men then went off, married younger women, and all of them have several children. My girlfriends express extreme bitterness over being childless. Abby, I'm afraid Jane will meet this same fate. Should I talk to her about my concerns? And what do you think about John's unwillingness to get a vasectomy? Signed, Disagreeing in Dallas. Dear Disagreeing, what John's father did by denying his own part in his divorce and placing the blame on his children was unconscionable. It was also a lie. Children do not cause divorces. Their parents do. If you want to maintain a close relationship with your beloved niece, you should not only not meddle in her marriage, but also keep your nose out of their sex life. John may be unwilling to have a vasectomy, not because he is selfish, but because he is afraid of the pain. The procedure is not painless, or because he mistakenly fears it will make him less of a man. But ultimately, he should take the necessary steps to prevent a pregnancy because he's the one who wants to remain childless. Dear Abby, as were most kids of the 80s, I was raised to think drugs are bad. Now, however, I live in a state where marijuana is legal. My job doesn't allow me to partake, nor do I have any interest in doing it. The problem is, I invited my on-again, off-again, long-distance boyfriend to visit. He says he has every intention of getting high, despite knowing my stance and discomfort. He says marijuana helped him recover from surgery and helps him sleep, and he just wants to get high. We clearly have two different opinions that will likely never be the same. He's my best friend and the easiest person for me to talk to. Is there any hope for us, or should we go back to being strictly friends? He said I can retract my invitation to visit if I choose. Do I allow him to visit and get high, or move on? I just don't understand the lure of marijuana. Signed, Confused in Colorado. Dear Confused, I'm not going to use this forum to debate the pleasures or perils of marijuana. If your on-again, off-again boyfriend is unwilling or unable to respect your wishes, recognize that what is a small problem now may take on larger proportions as you continue your involvement with him. Much has been written about marijuana, both pro and con. If you haven't already done so, it might benefit you to go online and read some of the current research. After that, if you still feel as strongly as you do, retract the invitation. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.